From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, loud booms heard over the United States. Investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe checks into that and some other stories of high strangeness, followed by an hour of conversations with Linda, your phone calls. Here's what's happening. Just an amazing story. Imagine this. Two rodents, all right? Two rats. One in North Carolina, the other is in Brazil, working together on a task by communicating telepathically thanks to implants in their brain. Electrical signals from a leader rat's brain were collected, encoded, then zapped into the follower rat's cortex in the form of an electrical signal. The follower rat then pressed one of two levers based on a light visible only to the leader rat. The Duke University experiment is the first time two animals have ever collaborated through such an artificial link and shows that the brain can be trained to act on electronic signals from other animals. They're going to start doing that with humans one day. Watch. New technological advances may make it possible in the near future to engineer a coal-powered car so clean that it produces nearly no polluting emissions, including carbon dioxide. A chemical engineer disclosed that he had discovered a way to get the energy out of coal without burning it, using iron oxide pellets as an oxygen source, and contained the reaction in a very small chamber from which pollutants cannot escape. The only waste product would be water and solid coal ash, no greenhouse gases. Amazing. The White House is threatening a presidential veto of a Senate Republican measure that would give President Barack Obama more authority and flexibility to find $85 billion in spending cuts this year. The measure is intended to replace the automatic cross-the-board cuts scheduled to kick in tomorrow. Investment advisor Mish Shedlock with us. Mish, can you give us an update about this sequester?
Sure. I mean, all this talk of the sequester, just look at the mainstream media hype over this. You know, Obama's threatening, you know, that vaccines for kids are going to be cut off. The New York Times has a lead story. Austerity is going to kill government jobs. The Washington Post reports that the sequester is going to, quote, sock a vulnerable economy. George, let's just look at the math here. In 2006, federal spending was $2.6 trillion. In 2008, it went up to 2009. Then we were supposed to have, remember this, George, a one-time increase on the budget to $3.5 trillion that was supposed to get us over this global financial crisis. We had, you know, what happened to this one-time increase? Did it go away, George? You know that it didn't. Now, federal spending is $3.5 trillion. It's actually gone up to $3.6 trillion this year, 33% more than 6 years ago.
Come Friday morning, what happens?
Well, I think it looks like they're going to, the sequester's going to happen. But here's the interesting thing here, George. The NBC and the Wall Street Journal did a poll. A majority of the Americans, 53%, said that they wanted Congress to move ahead with the sequester cuts or plan even more cuts. So the American public says we need to have these cuts or even do more of them. Yet we have all of this hype and all of this blame game, Republicans blaming Obama, Obama blaming the Republicans.
And nothing gets done.
And nothing gets done.
Mish, well, it's going to wake up in the morning. We're going to see what's going on here. People living near the damaged Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan have an increased risk of developing some cancers, according to the World Health Organization. The increased risk is limited to communities and some emergency workers exposed to radiation after that 2011 earthquake and tsunami. For those living in the rest of Japan, they say there is no health risk. Ah, the Temptations. Motown vocalist Richard Street, a member of the Temptations for 25 years, has died at the age of 70. Street's wife said he died at a hospital in Las Vegas after a short illness. He sang with the Temptation members Otis Williams and Melvin Franklin in the 50s, but did not join the group until 1971. Temptation singer Richard Street dead at the age of 70. Pope Benedict XVI has officially resigned, saying that he now will simply be a pilgrim, starting his last journey on earth. The pontiff, aged 85, was earlier flown by helicopter from the Vatican to his retreat near Rome. The College of Cardinals is now in charge of the world's 1.2 billion Roman Catholics until a new pope is elected. Well, next hour, Linda Moulton Howe, among her stories of high strangeness, will look at Bigfoot. And in a moment, we'll get an update. What's going on with the search for Bigfoot? Rettman Mullis joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. In a moment, we're going to talk about the incredible story of Earth with Bob Hazen. Wait till you hear this. But of course, as you know, we have been tracking and following stories of Bigfoot on this program for 20 years. Rettman Mullis, of course, he started his journey as a Bigfoot researcher after he saw one swimming in the Puget Sound area. And let's check in with him. Rettman, any updates on Bigfoot and the DNA and the search?
Actually, there is quite a bit going on. As a matter of fact, to start off with, there's four things I'll bring up real quick. Ray Kroah is actually feeling well enough to host a Western Bigfoot Society meeting on March 9th at the Home Plate Cafe in Portland. Originally, Dr. Sykes had taken us up on the invitation to come, but he couldn't change his itinerary, so he's not going to be at that meeting. But the
you there? Well, we've lost Rettman. He disappeared on us. Let's see if we can get him back. You there, Rettman? Nope, he's gone. So there goes his Bigfoot update. Oh, well. A ring of radiation, previously unknown to science, by the way, surrounded Earth last year before being virtually annihilated by a very powerful interplanetary shockwave. NASA's twin Van Allen space probes, which are studying the Earth's radiation belts, made this cosmic find. The surprising discovery. A new radiation belt around Earth reveals just how much we really don't know about outer space and our own planet. Robert Hazen, Bob is a senior research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Geophysical Laboratory. He has written a book called The Story of Earth, and he's the principal investigator of the Deep Carbon Observatory. Bob, welcome to the program. How are you?
It's great to be here, George.
Nice job on good old planet Earth, by the way. I can't believe 4.5 billion years old. What took it so long to develop?
Oh, man, what a great planet. Well, Earth just had a very long history, and it's got a long history to come. We're about halfway through, maybe not quite, in what's going to be a really epic biography.
All right, let's get into some possibilities here of this planet. How unique, Bob, is planet Earth compared to other planets that we're beginning to discover throughout the universe?
Well, Earth is unique in a number of ways. So far, there's a lot of space out there, but of the planets we've seen, Earth, of course, is the only one where we know there's life, and certainly the only one where we know there's intelligent life. Although, as you've mentioned earlier, looking at Congress, you've got to be a little bit concerned about that last statement. we're the only planet that has a giant moon. Which is just an amazing special feature of our planet. We're the only planet that has huge oceans of water. So we're a pretty special place.
You say Earth once rotated so fast that the sun rose every 5 hours. That's amazing.
Can you imagine that? Yeah, Earth spun really, really fast on its axis. And what happened was the moon was also up there in the sky, but it was about 20 times closer than it is right now. So imagine a moon that looks 20 times larger in diameter. So it's up there. It's whizzing around the planet. Earth is spinning on its axis really fast. But because of the tides, because the way Earth pulls on the moon and the moon pulls on Earth, the moon slowed Earth down. And so after this 4.5 billion year period now, we're going a leisurely 24-hour day. And I don't know about you, I'm looking forward to 25 and 26-hour days because 24 just isn't enough net anymore. But just wait another few hundred million years and you'll have it, because the moon is still slowing Earth down and we're slowing the moon down. So it's getting farther and farther away. Every year it gets farther away.
Bob, if the moon happened to be 20 times closer, what pushed it back out?
what pushed it back out. It really wasn't a push. It was a pull that moon exerts on the Earth. Remember, we have tides. So there's a kind of bulge that goes around the Earth. And you've seen that. If you live by the shore, you see the tides getting higher, the tides getting lower. Well, that tide itself has gravity, and it pulls on the moon. It slows the moon down. It slows Earth down. So Earth keeps rotating slower and slower and slower. Every time the moon goes around Earth, you get a slowing down because of this gravitational pull by the tides. It's just an amazing slow process, but over 4.5 billion years, that is a long, long time, and a lot happened.
Was the moon captured, or did it pop out of the Earth after this collision that we hear so much about?
You know, that's something that just has fascinated scientists for years and years. How in the world did the moon form? And the current thinking is that you can't really capture something the size of the moon and put it into a circular orbit. That doesn't work. And you can't just sort of let the moon butt off Earth because Earth's rotating so fast that a piece of Earth just floats out into space. What it looks like happened is after Earth had formed, there was another competing planet, something larger than Mars, that was more or less in our same area of real estate. And there's just the law of astrophysics. If you've got two planets that are trying to occupy the same space, they don't get along very well. And ultimately, they're going to hit each other. And the other rule of astrophysics is that the larger planet always wins. That was Earth, fortunately for us. The smaller one, we call it Theia because we got to give it some sort of name, and that's the name of a Greek god that was the mother of the moon.
Right.
So Theia smashes into Earth. It's completely obliterated. If you can imagine a planet like the size of Mars just essentially over the space of a few minutes smushing into Earth and just vaporizing.
Vaporizing?
Vaporizing. It basically just completely blasted to smithereens. You know, these two planets came together at many kilometers per second. I mean, this is a really amazing impact. And so over a period of weeks or months, you can imagine that this total devastation. Earth was completely a molten sphere. It was red-hot magma oceans encircling the entire globe. The atmosphere was filled with vaporized rock that rained down in these red-hot raindrops of silicate. It would be like being surrounded by volcanic droplets falling all over the face of Earth. And some of that material just didn't make it back to Earth. It was blasted out to the nearby region of space. That material coalesced to form our moon. So we have this very unusual set of circumstances that led to a gorgeous moon in our sky.
How did the moon end up then being, and how did all these objects end up being round? Just because they spin?
They're round because of gravity. Gravity pulls everything to a common center. If you have enough material, it's round. If you've probably seen photographs of some of those asteroids that are out there in space. They're not large enough to be round, so they look like these kind of odd,
rocks.
Bumpy,
yeah.
Irregular-shaped potato shapes, and you know who knows what. They're not particularly beautiful round spheres.
Right.
If you get above a couple hundred miles, 300, 400, 500 miles in diameter, then gravity pulls those objects into a round spherical shape. So that's what all the planets are. That's what the stars are. That's what the moon is.
Bob, for these planets, for the moon to form into something round and solid, to me, everything as this was happening had to have been not beyond just gases, but almost like a hodgepodge of some kind of material that kind of like glued itself together.
That's exactly right. The early solar nebula, as it's called, this is the cloud of dust and gas that led to the formation of the sun, Earth, other planets, the moons, all that material. That was at one point of just a very sort of thin gas or cloud of material. And 99% of that was gases, hydrogen and helium, which makes up most of the sun. And that leftover 1% was basically dust. And just, it's a huge quantity of dust. You know, you got a dust bunny in the corner of your room. Well, this was one very, very large accumulation of dust. And it all comes together and forms planets like Earth and Mars and Venus and Mercury. That's dust.
You witnessed, of course, you heard the story of the meteorite that hit over Russia a few weeks ago.
Wasn't that cool?
It was great. Thank God nobody was really hurt. 1,000 people injured, but I mean, it could have been worse. Tell me about the black market meteorite hawkers in the Sahara. What are these people?
Oh, my gosh. You know, this has become such a big thing. You know, almost anything in this world can become valuable if there are two collectors who want them really badly. And it turns out that, you know, whether it's comic books or old coins or you name it, they're at least two collectors. Well, the same thing is true for meteorites. There are several people in the world who have just become passionate about building meteorite collections. So meteorites have become extremely valuable. Now, they're really valuable to scientists because they are our oldest objects. A meteorite is the oldest thing you can hold in your hand. And it also gives you keys about the formation of Earth and other planets. But they're also just intrinsically fascinating objects. They fall from the sky. They've been orbiting the sun and other parts of our solar system for billions of years. And there are lots of different kinds. Some of them come from Mars. Some of them come from the moon. If you want to own a piece of moon rock, the only legal thing you can own is a meteorite that comes from the moon. So people pay, in some cases, millions of dollars for these. Now, where do you find meteors? Well, you don't find meteorites just in your backyard, because most meteorites just look like an ordinary old rock. You'd kick it aside. You'd get rid of it. You'd think that was in the way. But if you're in the desert, an odd black stone stands out. If you're in Antarctica, in the ice fields, an odd black stone just stands out. Those are stones that had to come from someplace strange, and they come from space. So the desert nomads now know to look for meteorites. They can spot them from their camels. They can spot them when they're walking along, and they know they're worth a lot of money. So there's now middlemen. There's a very active market in these things. If you go into Morocco to the desert, you know, you walk into little towns, and there'll be people in huts that basically have bags full of rocks that were collected in the desert. Some of them are meteorites, and once in a while, some of them are incredibly valuable.
Now, you said these meteorites are very, very old, almost as old as everything. So that would make it what, 4.5 billion years old?
4.5, 6, 7 billion is what people tell me is the oldest meteorite. And that's really the birth of our solar system. That's this material that formed right at the very beginning when the sun was just beginning to form, when all that dust was beginning to collect into the earliest, most primitive kinds of solid rock that surrounded the sun and made our planet.
It's an amazing story. How do we know some of these meteorites don't come from outside of the solar system?
You know, it's amazing because some of them, the meteorites themselves, the rocks, we think are all formed right around our sun. But the dust grains are from much, much before our sun. These are called pre-solar grains, before the sun. And some of these grains, they're microscopic, but some meteorites are just packed with these tiny, tiny little grains. You can see them in a microscope. And when I said the oldest thing you can hold in your hand is a meteorite, the oldest thing you can actually see, visibly see, are these tiny dust grains, some of which may be billions of years older even than our sun. It's an amazing thing. They carry the remnants of previous exploded stars.
Bob, you've talked about extinctions on this planet, and you say that we have had, what, 5 major extinctions?
5 major periods in the last 500 years when a large fraction of all the different life forms on Earth disappeared in a fairly short time. And by short time, I mean maybe it was, you know, a million years. Maybe it was an afternoon. It could have been a very bad day. Now, there are also probably 20 or more smaller extinctions, and these were not trivial occurrences. These are things where, you know, if you lose maybe 15, 20, 25% of all living things on Earth, so not doesn't make the big 5, but still, that's not something you'd want to necessarily be around in one of those days.
Well, it tells you how resilient this planet is, though, for life to continue to bounce back.
Great point. Life is incredibly resilient, especially microbial life. There's been microbial life at or near Earth's surface for more than 3.5 billion years. It just keeps on keeping on. It's amazingly robust. It lives in all these incredibly extreme environments, from the most acidic mine drainage dumps to Antarctic ice to high in the atmosphere to deep underground. That's microbial life. But then life that we think of, you know, the trees and the animals and plants and us, that's been around for more like the last 400 million years.
Well, it just seems like a drop in the bucket. Bob, we're going to come right back, talk more with you about your story, the story of Earth, and we'll take some phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. A couple things I want to point out, too. We've got the new iPhone app up and running. You can grab that and enjoy it. You can just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. That's for the iPhone app. Keep in mind, by the way, that it's not the website. It's an alternative to the website. You can still grab all the things you need on the full website when you just type in coasttocoastam.com. I saw today the beta version of the Android app, and it's dynamite. You're going to need the operating system of 4.0. Just make sure you know that for Android, but it's going to be great. Anyway, just go to coasttocoastam.com, join the club, and become a Coast Insider. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Bob Hazen with us, his book, The Story of Earth. You enjoyed writing this. I could tell just by the way it was put together, Bob.
Oh, gosh, it is a great story, and it's not really told very often. I mean, here we're talking about our planet, our Earth. You know, we should know our planet. We should know our home because it's the only home we're ever going to have, and it's just has had amazing $4.5 billion epic.
That would be cheap.
Astonishing. It's an astonishing story, and I love to talk about it.
What do you think about the planet possibly being a living organism all by itself?
You know, Earth's not a living organism per se, but it does have amazing feedbacks between life and rocks. That's something we're just beginning to understand, that I think about the origin of life all the time. I think about how in the world did a non-living world become infested with all kinds of life, you know, microbes and trees and fungus and us. And that's a process that required rocks and minerals. They were critical to the process. You need water, you need air, you need rocks and minerals. But now life comes along, and life creates rocks and minerals all the time. The surface of our planet is just covered with rocks and minerals. They're the consequence of life. We don't usually think of it in those ways, but it's this coevolution, this feedback between the life and the rocks. So it's just an amazing saga when you think about it in those ways. So in that sense, Earth is a living world, because it's so integrated, the life, the rocks, the minerals.
Bob, let's take spirituality out of this for just a moment. How did life begin? How did this complex combination of things occur?
Well, there had to be chemistry going on here, George. I mean, you think about it. You've got basic chemical ingredients. Carbon was really important. All the basic molecules of life use carbon. Oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, you know, these are basic chemical elements that are produced in stars. They were part of our planet. And then somehow the energy that was coming in from the sun, and also the energy that's stored deep within our planet, the heat energy radiating from the deep interior to the surface, these forms of energy help to organize the chemicals that we see right at the surface, right at that interface, that energetic place where life thrives today. That's where life originated. So what we do in the laboratory is we go and we study step by step the chemistry that could lead from the simplicity of rocks and minerals, oceans and atmosphere, to the complexity of life.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Well, it's amazing, but it's also, I think, amazing that this is probably an inevitable, it's a deterministic part of any Earth-like planet. We think that life is something that just happens spontaneously as the formation of rocks and oceans and atmosphere. The formation of life becomes a process that any Earth-like planet probably goes through.
Panspermia, with the planets and comets delivering the life or not?
Well, then you're just deferring the problem of where life occurred. If you want to say it came from someplace else, it still had to originate. And it is certainly possible. You know, one of the ideas that NASA is pursuing right now with its Curiosity rover is that Mars may have been a warm, wet, Earth-like planet very early in its history. Life may have first arisen on Mars, and we know that Mars rocks come, they're blasted from Mars, and they land on Earth all the time. We have more than 100 Martian meteorites have been found. And they could conceivably have carried microbes from Mars to Earth. So in that sense, it's possible that life got started first in our solar system on Mars and then transported here. That's very much an idea. We could all be Martians. Think about that.
We might be. Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, Martin, Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Martin.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good,
hi,
Martin.
Bob.
Martin,
I had a question.
Sure thing.
I had a question for each of you guys. First of all, I was wondering, George, if you guys could run a show on the declining sperm count that's going on. It's been down to 75%. I would imagine in about 9 months it'll be down to probably in the 90th percentile.
It is plummeting, there's no doubt. I'm not sure about a full show, but definitely part of our medical segments.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate
sure
that.
Thing.
And I just wanted to ask Bob if he ever gave any thought to if we've had any help from the people who live outside of our planet. I mean, if you look around, we have salt water on both sides, but running right down the middle. Lots of fresh water so we can live. There's just enough salt. If we didn't have a teaspoon of salt every day, we would die of diseases. Just enough zinc, just enough lead, just enough fish in the water, birds in the sky, animals on the planet. I was wondering if he ever gave that any thought to the possibility.
You know, on this program, Bob, we talk about extraterrestrial life and all the possibilities. What do you think?
Well, there's certainly no scientist on Earth who could discount that possibility, and I think that it remains fascinating. I mean, I personally feel like the universe must be crammed with life because there's so many planets out there. We're finding more and more every day. But in terms of how life evolved, remember, life evolved on a planet that has salt water in the ocean. Life evolved on a planet that has fresh water in the land. Life evolved on a planet that had lead and zinc and other elements. And so life will find a way. This is something we see with evolution all the time. Life adapts to its surroundings. Life is amazingly resilient and robust. If you have acid hot springs, microbes will live in those acid hot springs. If you have incredibly cold areas of the Antarctic ice field, life will figure out a way to live there too. So one way of thinking about this alternatively is instead of we've been helped from outside, is we help ourselves. Life figures out how to survive.
What do you mean by the boring billion?
The boring billion, you know, Earth's got a long history. And I suppose for all of us, every one of us, if you look at our biographies, there's probably one of those kind of lulls where things got a little bit quiet. You know, maybe you're stuck in the same job for a long period of time, or you didn't really have a great relationship going on. Well, Earth had its own billion year period when almost nothing was going on. That's about 2 billion years ago to 1 billion years ago. This period where it's astonishing. You look at the rock record, there's not a whole lot new that was happening. You look at what were the ancient oceans, and they seem to be pretty static. You look at life, there wasn't a lot of innovation, a lot of new stuff. Earth was just sort of drifting along in one sort of steady state. There were no ice ages. There were no hot spells. We just don't see anything in the rock record that would suggest that for a billion-year period, Earth wasn't changing very much. And you say, well, you know, it doesn't seem to be changing very much now, or maybe only slightly. But in fact, we've been in a period recently with, you know, glacial advances and glacial retreats and warming and cooling and so forth. Things happen very, very fast. A billion years ago, that wasn't true.
No, it wasn't. So that's why you say it was boring.
Well, boring in the sense that not a whole lot seemed to be going on. Now, frankly, I think every period of Earth history is fascinating because, you know, it's just like a biography of your family. I mean, you can, you know, every day there's something going on and you can tell people about it. So it's possibly we call it boring because we just haven't looked closely enough, or, you know, people, if you're a graduate student, you're getting a doctorate in geology, you're not going to devote your 4 years of a PhD to study a period that everybody thinks is boring because, you know, maybe they're going to think you're boring and not hire you. So people tend to look at other time periods. But nevertheless, I think there's a lot to be learned from that billion-year period of Earth history.
Steve in Tacoma, Washington West. Hey, Stephen, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Very good.
Hey, Steve.
Anyways, I hope I'm not missing the scope of the topic. my story and then a question. Many, many years ago when I was a teenager, I was walking up Pacific Avenue in downtown Tacoma, and I watched a bright comet go across the sky. And, of course, it burned up in the atmosphere. It's very pretty to see. And about maybe 5 or so minutes later, I'd walked up 2 blocks going up towards Martin Luther King, and a white, hot ash burned me in the face. Ever since then, even I did a paper on it in high school, too, and everybody laughed at me. Then this show comes on, and I said, you know, this guy might know. Has anybody actually allocated any funds to research whether these asteroids or the correct, I don't know what the correct termination for these would be, meteors, comets, I don't know, meteors probably, if they are responsible for causing forest fires, fields burning up? You know, a lot of people want to blame the cigarette. You know, some guy driving by flipped a cigarette out. What would you guys have to say about that?
Well, I think, Bob, that's a possibility that some object could have hit in a dry forest and may have ignited a fire, don't you?
Absolutely. Sure. We have meteors coming into Earth's atmosphere all the time. You see them streaking across the sky. And most of the things you see streaking are just little sand grain-sized things. But you were really lucky, Steve. You saw it sounds like a fireball, which is a much larger object. This thing that went flying across the Russian skies, of course, is a bigger object, too. And we know that some pieces hit the ground. They're hot. If they hit a dry forest, of course they can start a fire. Now, I think that we now have a pretty good system of radar and observation, so we know when a big object comes in to our planetary atmosphere. And so this is not something that happens like every day all around the world, but there's no question this has happened in the past and it will happen again. Fires started by rocks from space, if you can believe it.
What do you think some of the next future discoveries will be, Robert?
We are constantly trying to understand how Earth changes. One thing that's very obvious is Earth is an incredible planet of change. One of the things I learned working on the book was in the last 1 million years alone, and that's not very much time in a geological sense, there have been 10 or more times when sea level was 100 feet higher than it is right now.
Higher?
And there have been 10 or more times when sea level was 100 feet lower than it is now. Now, think about that. Think about every major coastal city in the United States, 100 feet higher, and it's gone.
They're gone. They're all wiped out. 50 miles inland. Easy.
And 100 feet lower, yeah, you're no longer a coastal city. You know, the coast is someplace way out there.
You're on some cliff somewhere.
Yeah. So
that is
isn't
amazing.
That incredible?
Yeah.
That's just the kind of change that we see in the last 1 million years. We need to understand changes because Earth is changing now. Earth is always changing. And so when you talk about climate change and global change, I hear people with this quote, save the planet. We have to save the planet. Well, no, I'm sorry, George. We don't need to save the planet. The planet is going to do quite well. It's used to change. It's the human race that we have to save.
What do you think happened to Mars, Bob?
Oh, Mars. Poor Mars. It was too small. It just wasn't Earth-sized. It's about a tenth the mass of Earth.
And I mean, it had it at one time. It had its water. It had water. It was primed, right?
It was a great place to live. It had everything you'd want in a planet. It was, you know, wet. It had beaches. You know, it had nice, very rich atmosphere. You know, everything you'd want. But what happened is water molecules evaporate. They go up high in the atmosphere. They get hit by the sun's ultraviolet rays. They break apart, and when they break apart into oxygen plus hydrogen, Mars is so small, the hydrogen escapes, okay?
So it didn't stick.
The water escapes. The water just goes off into space. And so
Mars goes up, comes back.
Mars dried out. It just became dry. It lost that atmosphere. It lost its water. And this happened probably as long ago as 4 billion years that things started getting sort of dicey in the Mars surface. And now it's...
It evaporated itself.
It mostly evaporated, and then it got cold, and it froze. So Mars is still a really interesting place, and there could very easily be life deep underground where it's warm and wet, but it's not warm and wet at the surface anymore, and that's the problem, George. That's why Mars is, you know, if we ever send a team of humans there's been a lot of that in the news lately. Mm-hmm. If we ever actually send a colony to live on Mars, they're going to struggle for a while because it's not very hospitable yet.
Let's go to Bill, West Hartford, Connecticut, the amateur astronomer. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, hi, Bob. Hi. I have a two-part question about life in our cosmos. Part one is about life on extrasolar planets, meaning, of course, planets orbiting other stars trillions of miles away, light years away. Part two is on Mars. Very briefly, I want to say, number one, regarding extrasolar planets, I read today on space.com that the James Webb Space Telescope that will be launched in just 5 years will be able to determine, because it will be operating in infrared radiation, the biomarkers, biosignatures of water as well as oxygen and methane in planets orbiting white dwarf stars that are dimmer, so that the light from the star won't obscure the chemistry of the atmosphere of those planets. And part two on Mars, when do you think NASA will come out with the data from the first drilling 2.5 inches into that rock by the Mars rover Curiosity? When will they come out with the data?
Hey, Bill, thanks for these great questions. In terms of exoplanets, the idea of a James Webb telescope to look for Earth-like planets, look for other planets that might have oxygen or water, that's really exciting. We still don't know if there might not be very different stars with different amounts of oxygen and iron and other elements in them, so that we have to think about the full range of unusual planets that might be out there. So biosignatures, I'd love to see something that looks like Earth, so we can say, wow, this looks like there might be life there. In terms of Mars, I just was at a conference over the weekend. The drilling went on, I believe, on Saturday, where they did the first analysis of that little bit of drill material. They haven't announced it yet. You know, all of us in science, we're just sitting on the edge of our seats. Man, we want that data. We want that data so badly, because it's exciting. We're learning stuff every day. And here's the amazing thing, Bill. The amazing thing is, right now we're living in a time when you don't have to wait like a year or 10 years or 20 years or someone to publish. NASA is going to release this data almost as soon as they get it, and they look at it through their own scientific community. We can all share in this adventure. There's never been a time in history when so many people could share so much excitement about understanding other planets, potential life on other worlds. This is an amazing time to be a science watcher.
What excites you the most about your work, Bob?
I love this idea of understanding the origin, evolution of life, and the distribution of life throughout our cosmos. This is a field called astrobiology. I've got funding from NASA and from the National Science Foundation that helps support this kind of research into some of the most basic questions that humans have been asking for thousands of years, and we're really at the cusp. I mean, within our lifetimes, within the next decade, we could have definitive answers. Yes, there's life on Mars. Yes, we understand how the origin of life took place, or how it might have taken place on a planet like Earth. We are so close to this understanding. This is really an amazing time to be a scientist and to watch science.
Well, when you look at this planet and its abundance of life, truly amazing species we haven't even found yet.
This is true. Species we haven't found and fossil species we haven't found. I mean, think about all the time we're discovering new kinds of dinosaurs and new kinds of fossil amphibians and fish and reptiles, and realizing this abundance of life. I love trilobites. These are ancient marine creatures that had legs and segmented bodies. You find the fossils, and they have eyes. These eyes look back at you. And there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of different kinds of trilobites in the fossil record. They keep finding new ones. It's amazing. Life was so abundant and is so abundant on this planet. To understand where it came from, how it's been changing, where it's going, what is the future of life on Earth, and are we going to voyage out to these other worlds, and are we going to become the great space explorers? Are we going to become the extraterrestrials in other worlds? I mean, this is an amazing future we have in front of us.
And I'm glad we are right in the middle of all of it. The Story of Earth by Bob Hazen. Back with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM.